Welcome to the REI Diamonds Show with Dan Breslin, your source for real estate investment jewels of wisdom.
Welcome to the REI Diamond Show. I'm your host, Dan Breslin, and this is episode 184 on buying vacation rental property with Avery Carl. If you're in the building wealth through real estate investing, congratulations, you are in the right place. My goal is to identify high-caliber real estate investors and other industry service providers, invite them on the show, and then draw out the jewels of wisdom. Those tactics, mindsets, and methods used to create millions of dollars and more in the business of real estate. Today, we are joined by Avery Carl. Avery runs the Short Term Shop, a high-volume boutique real estate firm focused on short-term vacation rentals. We cover exactly what's needed to get into and profitably operate a vacation rental. We also talk about a few of the hottest vacation rental markets in the U.S. and why those markets tend to be a more stable investment over the long term. And finally, we discuss a few reasons why adding a vacation rental or two or three is a perfect start or addition to any real estate investor's portfolio, no matter where you're currently located. Let's begin. All right, Avery Carl, welcome to the REI Diamond Show. How are you doing today?
Pretty good. How are you?
I am doing well. So we're just the beginning of February here for a timestamp. I'm curious where you're recording from in the country and what the weather's like there currently.
I am recording in 30A, Florida, so Panhandle, Florida, and it is about 65 degrees.
And is that cold for you guys there?
Yeah.
Yeah. Nice. Yeah, we're getting the polar vortex here in Chicago, and we have the ice shelf forming out the window here, and it's cold. It's making me want to jump in the car and drive to Florida and spend some time in a vacation rental, which they're all pretty much booked up in Florida right now, we checked, but we'll get to all that in a moment. So, Avery, do you want to start out by telling us how you got started in real estate and what does your primary business model look like today?
Absolutely. So I kind of ended up in real estate and real estate investing by mistake, or not by mistake. I just kind of fell into it. My husband and I moved to Nashville, Tennessee in 2013 from New York City. And obviously, who can afford to buy something in New York City when you're just starting out? So we moved to Nashville so that we could buy a house and have some space. And when we got there, I didn't have my real estate license yet. I was working as a marketing manager in the music business. And our real estate agent was trying to get us to buy in this really hip, super fast appreciating area of Nashville. And we didn't really want to do that because we were just coming from Brooklyn, really tired of neighbors. So we bought out in the country, but we thought, oh, you know, maybe we should snag one of those houses because they're appreciating really fast, which was a terrible strategy. I didn't know that at the time. But so we did buy one, and luckily that one ended up being a really good one. We still have it, and it cash flows like 2%. So that's ridiculous and unheard of. And luckily for us, it ended up being that way. After that, we thought, okay, well, this is something that we really want to scale and actually get a bunch of these things. So at that point, we started listening to podcasts and reading and actually educating ourselves on the thing that we had just spent a ton of money on. And from there, we had one down payment left, like one single family down payment worth of capital left. So we thought, well, what can we do with this money? What can we buy to make the most amount of money possible so that we can go buy more properties quickly? And we landed on short-term rentals. We didn't want to do that in Nashville because the regulations are just terrible in Nashville. They're constantly changing, and it's just not a good place for that. So we thought, where can we go that the regulations are friendly? This is something that people have always done and always will do. And so we found the Smoky Mountains, which we had vacationed at a lot because it's only about 3 hours east of Nashville. There, it's what I call a mature vacation rental market, which is what I focus on in my short-term rental investing now. So what I mean by that is it's a place where people have vacationed in privately owned, either single family homes or condos for decades and decades. So basically it was an Airbnb market before Airbnb or the internet even existed. And so we bought a property there that did really well. We didn't really have anybody to any mentors or anything in that space. So we developed all of our systems for managing remotely ourselves. Long story short, scaled one short term in the Smokies into 5 within about a year and a half. Then used all that cash flow, got about 20 long-term doors, scaled into the Destin, Panama City 30A market in Florida. We have 2 down here now. And then we're actually also under contract on the 12-unit multifamily for long-term. So we like to keep a diverse portfolio, but our strategy was and is that the short-terms made us so much money to start. It became a really good strategy to teach my clients. So somewhere along the way, I got my real estate license and opened up the short-term shop, which is an agency. We're brokered by eXp. And what we do is we help clients identify and buy the best short-term rentals in the best market. So the Smoky Mountains, Panhandle of Florida, Gulf Shores, Alabama, and Blue Ridge, Georgia. And basically, I became the agent that I wish I had when we started, who nobody could answer the questions about remote self-management and price per night and what properties should be able to make. So I became that person. And we teach people how to do the same thing that we did. So basically, we help them get the property, and then we teach them all of our systems to self-manage remotely so that they don't have to pay a property manager 25 to 40% of their gross income. And that way they can squeeze every dollar out of that short-term rental and then use that to scale into, you know, more short-term rentals or long-term rentals or whatever it is that they want their portfolio to look like. So that's what we do.
Nice. I love it. So the business model, it's a very interesting business model that you have specifically. I think that you guys have really evolved it quickly, starting from 2013 to 2020. And I have the luxury of having looked into the research and been to the websites and following you actually for a couple of months now before we had on got you together on the show here today. So it's impressive. And not really a turnkey process in that it's totally hands off, but it is definitely a way to mitigate a bunch of mistakes that I think short-term rental operators, owners, investors probably make. And I'll share my experiences. I have a 3-flat in Chicago, and there's a lot of Airbnb Chicago product. They were doing well 4 or 5 years ago when people would come in the summertime. We have a lot of traffic in the summertime. Believe it or not, it's kind of a vacation destination for people around the world to come to the city of Chicago for whatever the reason is, the beaches, the culture. It's just a large, you know, world-class city, I guess, here in Chicago. But my 3-flat was not exactly in the right neighborhood. So I bought it as a rental and then heard about short-term and thought, oh, this is great. I'll put furniture in and it will work out well. And over a 2 or 3 year period, I would have done 2 to 3 times better by having just a standard rental. So I just blindly went in there on this Airbnb, you know, this popular culture. And the listeners of the show probably remember a few years back me being excited on the show talking about my Airbnb, and I would let my family and my business partners come and stay there. I've since put it up for a standard rental, especially the pandemic has kind of crimped Chicago's allure around the world, and so does the neighborhood that this one is located in. It doesn't really fit, right? So I didn't buy the right asset, number one, was my mistake, which sounds like you help with that mistake. And the second piece of second mistake I made was I don't have the time to manage it. I don't have the time to be, you know, texting back and forth with guests and arranging and worrying if people are there. I mean, we did 283 houses that we bought and sold last year, so I'm like very busy with the main business. And I didn't have the time to really dig in and maximize the cash flow that was coming through my unit. And if I did self-manage, it would have gone a lot better because I think it was 30 or 40%. I don't remember the percentage, but I remember getting my statement from my Airbnb manager, and I'm like, this is not sustainable. I'm worse, significantly worse off than I would have had this as a conventional rental property. So, Avery, those are 2 mistakes I think you have already talked about how to avoid. But are there any other mistakes that you would list for somebody who does not own a vacation rental but loves the idea of owning a place in the Smoky Mountains, to maybe head out there in the off season once or twice, you know, throughout the year, but then for that thing to maybe pay for itself instead of sitting vacant. What would those mistakes look like, and how would you advise clients against making those?
So there's a lot of limiting beliefs more than mistakes that people make, thinking that they have to live near the property, that they have to be able to get over there in case of an emergency. But I mean, when you think about it, there's no situation that would require you to show up at the property. Like if the guest has a medical emergency, it's actually more of a liability than anything if you go insert yourself into that situation. And then everything else, like, you know, if a toilet breaks at the place, I'm going to do the same thing that I would do if the toilet 10 feet from me and the bathroom downstairs breaks. I'm going to call somebody to come fix it. So it's really the same thing. You're doing the exact same thing as if the property was across the street as far as maintenance is concerned. So just not getting started is a big mistake, because you do not have to live in the market. Not everybody can live in the market where they invest. I mean, I don't live in the market where any of my long terms are. And then the biggest mistake that I see people make with these things, especially in the markets that I'm in where, you know, there's more vacation rentals than there are people who live here, and it's always been that way. A lot of people get caught up in trying to make their place be just such a unique experience, and they end up over improving the thing and spending more money than is necessary. Whereas, you know, beach houses are going to rent. You know, mountain houses are, cabins are going to rent. You don't have to like turn it into a spaceship for people to rent it. So over improvement is a big one that I see a lot.
Okay. Yeah, that makes sense. So I got living near it, not necessarily. And that is a big limiting belief. I mean, I moved from Philadelphia to Chicago and then collected 10 rental houses in Philadelphia. I've never seen any of them. But I did live in the market and I was familiar with them first. And then for whatever reason, I still, because I live in Chicago, I find myself evaluating those 10 unit, 12 unit, you know, the multifamily deals, the 3, the 4 flats that are in Chicago. It just feels familiar. I live here, and there is that false sense of control I think I have. Avery, I did like a hot water heater repair, and I come from a construction background, so I can do all that stuff. But I did one on the unit one time, and I'm like, oh my God, this was not a good idea at all. And ever since, it's been the same thing that you said. I pick the phone up and I call someone to go there anyway. So what difference does it make if I'm 4 miles or 450 miles away from the rental property? In fact, being farther might be a blessing, because you're forced to learn how to do it at a distance, and you're not tempted to go spend a weekend in there painting and doing a turnover or doing the cleaning jobs for the Airbnb. You're forced to pick the phone up and call somebody to do that service.
Exactly.
So let's talk about asset price and down payment that would be expected to buy a vacation home in the markets that you're located. Can you give me maybe like an example of what people would expect and what kind of money they should be bringing to the table if they were considering this type of investment?
Yeah, absolutely. So you can get a 1-bedroom to 2-bedroom for $250 to $300 in pretty much all the markets that I'm in. It's going to be super competitive. Like the Smoky Mountains are really, really competitive right now, so it's going to end up getting bid up higher than that. But that's kind of the starting like barrier to entry. And then if you're looking for, I prefer that. So the real return on investment comes at the 4-bedroom and up mark, because you are over doubling your income, but the expenses are only about 10, 15% more, depending on a few factors. So for a 4-bedroom in those markets, at a beach market, 4 bedrooms, you're looking at in Gulf Shores, maybe $450, in Destin maybe $750, and in the Smokies somewhere in between that. So just depends on the market, and then income is going to be dependent on a few factors, like, you know, a 20-year-old cabin in the Smokies that's a cute, nice place to stay but nothing too fancy will gross around $75,000, but then like a brand new, photographed really well, you know, light and airy, modern looking cabin will gross closer to $100,000. So it's definitely a range, which can make the analysis of a short-term rental investment a little bit trickier than a long-term, but everything's a little bit of a range.
Yeah, and I'm glad you said that, and that's probably another thing. I would assume that you're adding the value for your clients and being able to really understand kind of the nuance of what's expected. Because if I were to go into this market and look at, say, something on the lower end of the price point, it's a little more dated, but I'm like, oh, yeah, Avery said 100 grand is what an Airbnb goes for here in the Smoky Mountains. But the reality is it's 75. Like, that's a hard one to recover from if I've already put my down payment in and, you know, I'm committed to the deal already versus you telling me the truth. I mean, that's obviously your underwriting skill is something that is hard to put a price on that your clients would receive, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, I am going to be honest with, I've lost clients before because I had one who I was showing her, we were in Florida and I was showing her like $500,000 to $700,000 properties that were two blocks off the beach that were going to have the highest return on investment. And, she really wanted this $1.3 million three bedroom that was very far from the beach and, did not like my opinion on that. I told her it was a terrible idea and she went and used another agent and bought it. So,
wow.
You do. Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, I'm sure she's not going to buy another one. And that's kind of my business model too, is I want my clients to buy what they are going to be the most successful with in hopes that they will come back and buy more with me, because a rising tide raises all the ships. So if they're successful, we're all successful.
Yeah, that makes sense. And so, like, you know, to kind of plug the down payment piece, let's talk financing. So, you know, example, let's just pretend I have one house. I come to the table. We're going to buy the $450,000 example that you said. Am I having to put like 25% down and get commercial financing? Is there more favorable financing structures for me buying a second home here in a vacation market that you might be able to connect me with?
Indeed. I see where you're going with this. So, all the conventional financing options are available. So, you know, 20, 25% down conventional financing. You can get commercial if that's what you want to do. If you're out of conventional loan, sorry, you can get commercial if you're out of conventional loans. But one thing, a kind of creative financing, but it's not that creative because it is a conventional loan, that a lot of people use is the 10% down vacation home loan. And there are a few stipulations in order to get that, and this is not lending advice, so definitely ask your lender about the stipulations and regulations around it, but I can give you kind of an overview. So you have to have the intention of staying in the property for at least 14 days a year per Fannie Mae guidelines. It has to be 65 miles away from your primary at least, and you can't put any sort of a contract on it that takes the control of the property away from you. So like a lease, for example, or a property management contract, but it doesn't say anything in the Fannie Mae guidelines as of now that about being able to rent out your property when you're not there on Airbnb and VRBO. So a lot of people utilize that for their first one. And then you can also get one of those per market. So you can go get a second home loan for 10% down in the Smoky Mountains, and then another one in Gulf Shores, Alabama, and, you know, Big Bear, California, you know, wherever you might want to go. You can do that as long as your DTI supports it.
Interesting. And I guess that the DTI is debt to income, and I'm assuming that the income that's generated from the vacation rental itself would at some point be counted. Does it have to show up on tax returns for a certain number of years before they can count it, so you can kind of, you know, leverage into four or five different markets, like you said?
Yes. Yeah, so it being a conventional loan, your DTI does have to support it. So there are, like, one lender I work with only requires one tax return worth, so 1 year of income to show, but most of them are going to require two. So that's definitely, you know, everybody who's listening to a real estate investing show, I'm sure, knows to call more than one bank. So definitely do that.
Yeah, it makes sense. And that's a huge thing I want to underline, that you have this contact for the specific lenders. So a lot of my real estate investing, I start with the financing options. I host this real estate investing show, and I get a lot of ideas from great guests like yourself who bring to the table. That's brand new news to me that you could have several vacation homes in several markets. I think that's fantastic. One of the things when I'm approaching my real estate investments, there's some mistakes I made that were in the buy and hold sector. Those houses in Philadelphia were very low price. And it had more to do with my comfort zone because I grew up like with not a lot of money and I kind of had a like a completely broke to being okay in life experience as part of my story. And it made me, you know, fearful about higher price points. And when I bought one of my rentals, a $450,000 building, I think it was, and those numbers, man, it took a leap of faith for me to want to sign those mortgage documents. But after it was done and I look back a year compared to my $65,000 rentals, I like the idea of a higher price point. So if I'm personally going to look at, you know, a one or a two bed at $250,000, $300,000, or I was going to look at the four bed, especially as you're telling me that there's this higher ROI and there's potentially more income from the larger property, I also like that higher dollar price point. So I'd rather have $450,000, $500,000, $600,000 because I'm able to get further leverage on my down payment. If it's a $500,000 property and I put $100,000 down, I have this mortgage at fixed interest for, you know, fixed for 30 years at today's low rates are outrageous. So now I have this vacation rental paying off a $400,000 debt that 30 years in the future, it's at least worth the same $500,000 that I paid, and I paid all that mortgage down versus the lower price point property. To your point about having the same kind of expense load, I still have to run a one or a two bedroom property. And even though it only cost me $250,000, and maybe I only have to risk $200,000 on the mortgage, the return is kind of like it's half. The mortgage pay down only is $200,000 that I'm getting for the same amount of work and effort of renting the property out week after week after weekend after, you know, paying the insurance, all the things that go along with it. So I love personally the idea of looking at assets with a price point that's high, not value, not I'm overpaying for the property, but the price point of the asset itself is high. And then my mortgage balances are high and I'd rather be borrowing as much money as I can to get that long-term leverage on my return. Does that make sense?
Totally.
Yeah. Cool. So let's do another example here. How would you advise a client who is making, let's say, $100,000 a year for the last 4 or 5 years, tax returns aren't going to be an issue, and they have $500,000 of investable cash. It's saved up. It's sitting in the bank. They can use this for down payments. What would your advice be? Let's say whether it was a client or a good family friend of yours, right? I want the same advice you'd give to the family friend on diversification, if any, between rent, vacation rentals and long-term rentals, and what percentage maybe of that $500,000 down payment firepower would you allocate to each bucket?
That is a really great question. So there are a few ways you can go about it. I would recommend you really kind of need about 3 vacation rentals to really kick out, you know, to really start snowballing quickly to be able to go buy more long terms quickly. So with that 500, there's you could even zoom in a little bit further. So within those 3 vacation rentals, you could get 3 in 3 different markets, or there's also merit in, you know, having your systems in one market and just adding to that system. I would recommend, though, whatever percentage you allocate for short-term rentals, whatever your set amount of capital that you're going to spend on short-term rentals is, I would spend it on a fewer number of larger properties, meaning 4 bedrooms and up, rather than a bunch of 1 and 2 bedrooms, because it's the same amount of work on your end to manage a 1 bedroom as it is a 6 bedroom. 6 bedrooms is going to make a lot more money. And then you also, when you add in a bunch of little tiny properties, you now have like 5 roofs to leak. You have 5 HVACs to go out. You have 5 sets of guests to manage. So it's just not as efficient, in addition to not having as high of a return, to have a bunch of small ones rather than 1 or 2 bigger ones. So I would definitely want that person to weigh those options as well. And there's, you know, there's also the all the eggs in one basket approach as well. So, you know, if you have 1 4-bedroom rather than 2 2-bedrooms and somebody cancels, well, that's 100% of your income for that weekend rather than half. So there's a few ways to do it, but I recommend a smaller number of larger properties than a larger number of smaller ones. And I would say maybe 25% short-term rentals and 75% long-term.
Yeah, it sounds about right. I have no experience on what the right number is. That sounds about right. So you'd mentioned the 12 unit that I think you were looking at or you were buying. I assume that you have some kind of balance here. Would you speak to that maybe in your own experience too, just to add additional context?
Yeah, so the 12 unit I'm looking at will be a long-term. It's in the Midwest also. So I don't have like a set. I don't look at my portfolio really and say, okay, it's time to add another short-term or it's time to add another long-term. I just kind of look at where the deals are. Like, for example, I have been investing in single family and duplexes in Chattanooga for the past 2 or 3 years, and it's been Californicated, like all the Californians have come in and and spending their cash, and now there's no deals anymore. There's no even wholesale deals. There's no deals in Chattanooga anymore. So we shifted our focus for single families to kind of right around here. So we're living on the panhandle of Florida now mostly, and then sometimes in the Smoky Mountains. So we're kind of keeping our long-term to like the South Alabama region for the single families and small multis, but then we're in the Midwest for our bigger multis. So we just kind of like adapt and pivot based on where the deals seem to be falling into place the easiest for us. But since I'm in the short-term market, you know, digging through short-term properties all the time, if I see one that looks great, I will get it. So I know it's not really the answer you're looking for. It's not really a quantifiable answer, but I am very much an opportunist when it comes to deals. It doesn't matter what asset class it is. If it is a good one and it comes across my desk, then we're going to look at it pretty hard.
Nice. And so you are in the Florida market. Smoky Mountains is Tennessee. And what was the other market?
So Smoky Mountains in Tennessee, Panhandle of Florida. So that's everywhere from Destin, Florida, all the way over to like Alligator Point, called the Emerald Coast and the Forgotten Coast. And then Gulf Shores, Alabama, and also Blue Ridge, Georgia, which is a mountain market.
Nice. So I asked that specific question as a lead-in, too. I noticed that my own ability to spot opportunities and spot trends, because I operate in the Atlanta region, 2 to 3 hours, we've done deals in Blue Ridge. We do 70 deals a year maybe in the Atlanta market. We'll probably do 100 this year. Philadelphia is where I grew up, so I do business there, and we'll probably do the same number there. And in Chicago, we will probably do the similar numbers, and I live here now. So I've had the opportunity. I've been in and out of a couple different markets. We failed out of Colorado, as an example. I was in Florida. I kind of pulled out of Florida. Our business model didn't seem to really gain traction there, too competitive, whatever the case was. But where I'm going with this is by looking at several different markets and having to spot trends, the way the cities were maybe developed or built, or if I noticed something that was happening in Atlanta and I was able to kind of say, oh, wow, look, it's starting to happen here in Philadelphia, my ability to underwrite deals has gone to a level I probably never would have needed to go to had I stayed in one market exclusively. Have you noticed any superior underwriting skill development of your own in being a multitude of markets?
Yeah, because, you know, the seasonality is different in beach markets versus mountain markets. The insurance is different. The maintenance is actually more on a log cabin than it is, you know, on a beach house. So there's all these different little factors that you have to learn in the different markets. Although the markets themselves, all things considered, are very, very, very similar markets. It's just a different natural resource that people are coming to visit and maybe a different property type that rents the best. But yeah, it's definitely, I've had to become a very specific expert in underwriting short-term rental deals.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. Yeah, I would assume that was the case, and I'm happy to hear it was. So a few months ago, this is 2020 now, April 2020, you were on a friend of mine, Reed Goosen's podcast, and you made a few predictions about how COVID shutdown had just occurred. So it was within a few weeks of the middle of March when things froze and everybody didn't know what was going on. And the uncertainty, I'll have to link to the episode in the show notes because it's a very interesting time capsule, your conversation with Reed about the general feeling in psychology of how COVID and real estate and investment and the uncertainty was during that period of time. But you made a prediction that COVID would cause the vacation rental market and the general real estate market to boom. So has that occurred in the markets that you're operating right now?
Yes, it most definitely has, even more than I ever thought that it would.
Yeah, it's very interesting. So have bookings kind of gone through the roof? What about days on market? Do you have a general feel for like the quantifiable heat in each market of the Florida Panhandle, the Smoky Mountains, the Gulf Shores, Alabama, and the Blue Ridge? I mean, are properties disappearing in 7 to 10 days? Is it 2 to 3 days? Is it like 14 to 21 days? How fast do you and the client have to move when you see the opportunity?
So in the Emerald Coast area and in the Smokies, those are the two hottest because they've, even before COVID, they've been on all the lists for best places to invest in short-term rentals for several years. But I mean, it's almost negative days on market. So when I get a listing, it is gone before I even get it to the MLS because we make our pocket listings available to our clients only before we list it. And, they never make it to the market. I think I've sold like 60 off market properties in the past 3 or 4 months just because of that in the Smokies. And same thing in the Emerald Coast. It's within a day, things are multiple offers. And I tell people when they're new clients of mine, if you're not comfortable having to be really, really aggressive and offer immediately and ask questions later, you know, do your due diligence on numbers and HOAs and all that after you're under contract, and then just use the inspection contingency to get you out if there's something weird, then like just don't, it's not going to happen because clients will get really irritated when they're like, oh, can you ask the listing agent this list of questions? And then before they even answer us, the property's gone and they get really frustrated by that. Those two markets are ridiculous right now, but the numbers still work. You just have to be able to move fast.
Yeah, that makes sense. And like to underscore your point there, so like a real estate investor will succeed or will fail based on their comfort and ability to underwrite a deal first, but to actually make the offer. And what you said, you have the inspection contingency in there. These are pocket listings. I mean, this is like a no-brainer, no-risk scenario. You just have to say, okay, put the offer in at $450,000. Is that what you're suggesting? Avery, fine, $450,000. Let's get the inspection started process. So, yeah, it's frustrating, and that tire-kicking kind of thing like that does not fly in a hot market, and it's probably not going to fly anytime in 2021 in almost all of the markets across the country. And, like, one of the things I made an intentional effort toward years and years ago was that I was going to make an offer, you know, every time. It didn't matter if I didn't quite like the property. For me, I'm flipping houses, right? And, you know, it's a busy street. I don't like it. I have to offer less. It's a one-bedroom house. It's going to be impossible to sell. I don't care. There's probably a buyer and probably a number significantly lower than what they're asking that works for them and works for me to take the risk. And like any house, even the ugly duckling, almost within reason, there's probably one or two with like a meth lab in there I would pass on. I'm making an offer every time. Make the offer. And some of my offers, I don't have the clause for inspection when I'm buying as is. My offer has to be competitive in a different environment. It has to be cash. It has to be as is. And there is not going to be backing out. I'm going to lose earnest money. But I've gotten comfortable with, you know, I'm going to make an offer and I'll risk earnest money in some instances. Whereas I get it with a $450,000 vacation home, you may not have to do that. But it sounds like some of the benefits of being your client, like I hear this pocket listing thing and I'm thinking, oh, this is great because I can buy a vacation home from the pocket listing scenario at the price that you're suggesting. And it's probably high because we're riding trends up in these markets, and these markets are going to continue to be desirable probably forever and worth more money, you know, next year than they are this year. But, you know, I hear the pocket listing thing. I think, wow, this is great, because if I did buy it today at the pocket listing price and the market is as hot as you're telling me it is, if it were to go on the open market, it's probably going to sell for more money than what I'm having to pay as a result of me having the connection to the pocket listing. Right?
Right, right. Just by way of not as many people having access to it, if you were to turn around and list it, it would get bid up in most cases, yeah.
So how do you find inventory? I mean, how do you even have product to sell people who would pick the phone up and call you right now?
So, you know, all the traditional ways, but I sell so much real estate that I have a lot of past buyers that I can just reach out to that own stuff now that, you know, over the course of my career. I mean, like last year we sold 350 vacation rentals.
And nice.
So so we have a big, big, big network of owners and investors that we can pull from and say, hey, and a lot of people are 1031 exchanging right now. A lot of people are worried about the political climate, which I'm not particularly, but a lot of people are worried they're going to lose their ability to 1031 exchange. So I've got I've been able to pull a lot of inventory out of that, out of past buyers that want a 1031 exchange, what they have now. So that's been my strategy right now, past buyers.
Nice. Yeah, that makes sense. And so I'm going to go out on a limb and make an assumption that you can confirm or deny, but 2013 through 2021, we're talking 7-8 years, you have past clients who bought at certain price and they're selling now. I assume they're not breaking even and there's profit involved in that sale if the 1031 is part of the conversation here?
Oh, yes, quite a bit.
What's the average appreciation been over those 10 years? I mean, if you were just throwing a dart.
Oh, my God. I mean, in the past 2 years in the Smokies, it's almost doubled.
Yeah, that's remarkable. I have a friend, yeah. A couple of my friends do the vacation rental thing, and I like I said, I'm just like so busy with running the business that I couldn't imagine having to do even a couple text messages. I'm going to have to find a way to, you know, figure out how to get it done. But a friend of mine bought a property, was on the beach. It was like $450,000, something like that. And I'm like, man, that thing is outrageous. I remember he's putting it on Facebook and he's going to do this and renovate it and vacation rental. And he did all that. And, you know, no one could have seen what was coming down the pike with COVID, a drastic drop in interest rates and a sudden primal urge to go to these vacation destinations and mm-hmm. buy second houses when COVID hit. But it was interesting. I mean, he sold it for, I think, $650,000, and he got a lot that he was able to peel off the side. And he posted it on Facebook. Like, wow, that worked out well. And it sounds like it's working out well for a lot of the clients. Do you expect that trend to continue, or are there any troubling trends or troubling risk factors that a client would want to be aware of to go into this with both eyes open, you know, that might stop somebody?
So the risk with vacation tourism dependent markets is that you're not going to be able to convert it to a long term. If everybody who owned a vacation home in these markets had to convert to long term, it would not happen because there's not enough primary residents in these markets. However, we did just have a really nice case study with COVID because that's the absolute worst case scenario. And it actually ended up being a good thing for owning in these markets. So I'm sure there were a few people who freaked out and tried to convert to long term, but for the most part, in the markets that I'm in and the investors that I know, nobody did that. Nobody had to. It was a month of being shut down. You should have enough cash reserves that's not going to kill you. And then it was back to business as usual, actually better than business as usual. But I think as all the big metro markets continue to have these clashes with short-term rentals and not wanting them around, those investors are going to, you know, they're used to short-term rental money, and they're going to go find a place where they can buy a short-term rental, which is these tourism heavy markets where the regulations are friendly. So I think those factors alone, aside from the fact that people, you know, just mountain property and beach property is desirable in general, I think that's going to keep it on an upward trend. I don't know that this breakneck appreciation is going to continue forever, but I do think that it will continue to appreciate for sure.
Yeah, that makes sense. So let's just talk for a moment. You know, if we had someone who was in their listening to the show right now, we put ourselves in their shoes. I think back to like when I had to sign the mortgage documents on that 400K mortgage I shared earlier, or I think about like the first time I ever bought stocks and I wired off a couple $1,000 to like TD Ameritrade. And I'm like, man, am I ever going to get this money back? Right? Like what? Am I doing a wrong thing? Is this even like real? And then a few years later and the investments go up and you don't have that fear any longer. When you bought your first vacation rental and you guys set out for that, can you talk about the emotions that you had to go through in those couple weeks from maybe when you made the offer, maybe before settlement, like, am I doing the right thing here? And then what it feels like to be on the other side of that now that what you guys hoped for has worked out?
Yes. So when we bought our first one, we didn't have any mentorship. We had didn't know anybody who was doing the same thing. We had no direction. We just had an idea and some systems that we had kind of put together, and that was it. So it was terrifying because at the time that was like the last dollar that we had, and we closed, and then we had like we stayed there for a long weekend because we needed to replace some stuff and work on it, and we stayed up until like 3 o'clock in the morning with anxiety for those 3 nights before we got it up on Airbnb and got our first booking, thinking, oh my God, did we make a mistake? Is this going to work? Have we just spent all our money on something that's not going to make us money? And it, you know, the anxiety started when we were under contract, and then it only got worse until we got our first booking. And then when we got our first booking within like 5 seconds of listing it on Airbnb. And then we were like, okay, all right, this looks like this is going to work. And then we calmed down. So it's terrifying to buy your first one, especially if you don't just have a lot of play money laying around. It's definitely very scary. So I have to remind myself about that experience now, because we do so much, you know, so many deals that it just becomes kind of automatic for us. And I have to think back to how I felt when I was on the other side of it for the first time. And it's scary for sure.
Yeah. And I think you hit the nail spot on the head, right? With, It's really, it's like the anxiety about making an investment at all. And I think that part of what you went through and what I went through, we had to take this step of faith, whatever you're investing in. It's obviously going to be easier if you have guides, mentors, experts, you have all the knowledge and everything, but there still comes a moment when you have to wire the money. You have to sign the contract. And the tricky thing too is like, to get to a place of having an abundant amount of money where the investments are nowhere near as scary, you still have to take the first step and make it. And usually when we're making that step, it's like you, it's like me. Like, we didn't have a lot of money. Like, if this didn't work out, when I bought that property, if those tenants, all three of them went bad, it would have put me in a really, really tough situation. But, you know, I was able to get through that. And so it's like you have to go through that anxiety ridden moment to like get to the point where you're able to kind of gain that volume and keep moving on. So Avery, are there any books that you would recommend to clients, maybe that have to do with overcoming the anxiety around investment that we talked about in general, maybe about real estate, maybe about business, I don't know, maybe about life in general, maybe one or two books that you'd recommend to friends or clients?
Yeah, so Traction by Gina Wickman is a great one, especially for, it's not about self-managing short-term rentals, but it's about managing a business. That's my favorite. Obviously, everybody that's listening to this has already read Kiyosaki. There is another one called Clockwork that's by Mike Michalowicz, kind of the same, along the same lines as Traction, but those two are my favorite right now.
Nice. So I guess we didn't cover it, but this is the REI Diamond Show, and we talk about the crown jewel of wisdom as we cap each episode, and we'll set the stage. Let's say the bank account's like kind of at zero. You have no deals on the board. You're not the real estate agent with momentum that you have right now, and you are restarting your career in real estate right now in 2021. I mean, how would you get started knowing everything that you know now but without the momentum behind you?
You really just have to pull the trigger and learn as you go. You can analyze yourself into and out of deals 100,000 times. And I have never thought to myself, I wish I would not have bought that piece of real estate. But I think to myself all the time, oh, I wish I would have bought that one thing that I looked at and decided not to buy. You really just have to pull the trigger at some point.
Yeah, you're right about that. I mean, we're in a good spot in real estate, so it's easy to make the observation now when everything is kind of up and the tide is where it is. And there were moments, I was in real estate since 2006, you know, on, and we went through a moment when the tide went out very hard and very quickly and left people kind of high and dry. However, even the people who were left high and dry, in a lot of the cases, I'm sure there's a handful of situations that have not quite cured with time, but even the deals that were bought in 2005 and 2006 at top of the market prices, you know, over time, the market catches up and sort of even corrects maybe the mistakes that we made. And that was like a drastic one. And we've seen stuff, you know, from 04, 05, 06 sell for significantly more money in a lot of markets around the country, at least the ones that I'm in the recent time. So it's like, even if you do accidentally overpay a little bit, as long as the numbers are going to make sense and you can carry the property with cash flow that generates from the property, you know, give it enough time and like the bad deal becomes okay. Like I've had some bad deals that became okay over time that, you know, that make it a lot easier for me to pull the trigger and just move forward and make the offer. So Avery, as we close the episode here, do you want to kind of mention the markets just one final time and maybe direct listeners where they can get more Avery Carl or information about you, your service, vacation rentals in general?
Yes. So you can find me on my website, www.theshorttermshop.com or on Instagram at theshorttermshop.
Nice. All right, cool. Well, hey, I had a blast. I had a lot of pages of notes, ton of wisdom here. I thank you, Avery, for coming on the show.
Thank you very much for having me.
Low-cost capital is the fuel of any volume real estate investment business. As a real estate investor, I am sure you're well aware of these two facts. First, your business is driven by access to capital, or starved from a lack thereof. And two, you make more money when you reduce the cost of said capital. Whether you're looking for hard money loans to fix and flip houses, rental portfolio loans, or even a line of credit, Lending Home offers the most competitive rates in the market, currently as low as 6.49%, which is good for fix and flip single family loans. I pay 10% myself at fundrehabdeals.com to my private investors. So at 6.49%, if you like that interest rate, go to reilineofcredit.com. Even if you're not currently in the market for a loan at this very minute, I encourage you to still go through that 1 minute sign up process right now so you can get on the email list. That way, once you're ready and you have a deal or a few, their name is top of mind. Plus, as a bonus for signing up through reilineofcredit.com, you'll receive a free iPad when you close your first loan. That's reilineofcredit.com. And thank you for tuning in to this episode of the REI Diamond Show. Remember to review and subscribe on your favorite podcasting app. Just search REI Diamonds and click subscribe. Are you interested in receiving the weekly Big Idea email, where I provide the most valuable jewel of wisdom I discovered during the recording of the most recent episode? Sign up at reidiamonds.com. At that site, you can also access the 184 episode archive. Again, that's reidiamonds.com. So my main business is buying and selling houses through Diamond Equity Investments, the company I founded in 2006. To date, this year, in 2021, we have bought and sold 39 houses. And we currently have another 117 in our inventory, either under construction or under agreement and awaiting closing. That said, here's how we can do business. Number one, are you interested in having access to the best real estate deals in your market? In other words, access to deals that you can buy at low enough prices to actually profit after renovating and reselling? If so, go now to www.accessrealestatedeals.com. Number two, If you're an accredited investor who enjoys double-digit returns and you'd like to potentially invest passively in my real estate deals, go to fundrehabdeals.com and sign up to receive my private mortgage investment opportunity emails. And number three, finally, I am always buying houses that I can flip and occupied apartment buildings with below market rents. If you have a deal that fits that description in either Atlanta, Chicago, or the Philadelphia region, please send me an email with the details. We are at the conclusion. So next up we have Kent Clothier joining us to discuss reverse wholesaling and the upcoming trends in residential real estate investing, what to expect later this year as we get through into 2022. Getting ahead of those trends will position you to profit. I'll catch you and that topic on the next one, my friend.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the REI Diamonds Show with Dan Breslin. To receive email notifications of new weekly episodes, sign up at www.reidiamonds.com.